Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, hello, everyone. Happy, I mean, we're officially underway in basketball season, so that's pretty happy.
Yeah, that's a thing. Let's go with that. I can't think of anything else that might be, like, top of mind for happy week. Happy SoCon SEC Challenge week.
Oh, yes. Always great for those of us who rely on the SEC in large part to, have interesting stuff happen. It's a great slate of games for them.
It's a wacky week in general. I have my one article a week that I usually do over at the Comeback, and I was like, usually there's like a storyline, because I try to avoid like the popular storylines and like try to go for something a little bit more under the radar. But like I was looking around and I'm like, shit, I got nothing. Just looking at the games themselves, and I think a large part of that was the SoCon Challenge and the fact that, you know, most of the SEC wasn't really facing anyone. There's still not a ton of big games on this weekend. I know as much as I support Western Michigan getting game day this week, I do wish that it had been Washington State Colorado, because I think the novelty of that is just as much, if not more so. Versus the novelty of being in Kalamazoo.
Well, there was your weekly Dan can't get his stipend muted, which literally happens, I think, every time you talk to me for the first time.
That's fine.
I write a thing we've done a couple weeks in a row, just kind of projecting where game day will go every week from here on out. And both weeks I thought it would be Colorado Wazoo. With maybe West Virginia, Oklahoma, they threw the screwball. I mean, I'm happy for Western Michigan. That should be an interesting game day. I'm excited for them to inevitably talk to PJ Fleck, which will be fun. But going to Colorado would have been pretty cool, considering they're definitely one of the best stories of the year. Just how far they've come, and they lend hope to those of us who root for programs that haven't been very good for a while.
Colorado's
in a way. Colorado has been like a way worse place than Syracuse too. Like they've been straight down. Like they haven't even had like a decent year here and there like we have. So yeah, it's either way. I mean, it's a weird week, and sometimes that's what game day does. They'll either go to like a D3 game. I think they went to like Williams and Williams and Amherst a couple times, and they went to, I think, Harvard Yale one year. So I support that too. Yeah, would have been cool to see them go into Colorado, but if Colorado stays playing the way they have, I mean, there will be more opportunities in the next couple of years. They haven't been there since 96, I remember. I looked it up.
Wow. There you go. All right. Now, the reason most people are listening to this podcast, Syracuse. This is the first football-basketball episode of the season. There will be at least two more of these, maybe more, depending on how these next two games go for Syracuse football. Nonetheless, Dan, we jump in with injuries. Injuries have not been kind to Syracuse this year. Eric Dungy headlines the group, but do you have a second worst injury in a season filled with them?
It's tough after that. I mean, I mean, if Steve Ishmael's down, that's not great. I think you can overcome it, considering how deep the receiving core has been. I would say it's just got to be and this is a total top edge, not just one person, but like just the whole array of offensive line injuries has probably been the biggest one, because that's kind of hurt Dungy and what he can do. That I think even makes even more of an impact on Mahoney, who's not as quick to release the ball and is a little different of a quarterback. And it's thrust just like very inexperienced players into the fray here. So I think that's the answer. But I mean, you can pull injuries out of a hat with this, with how this year is going. It's all over the place. Hello.
Oh, sorry, Dan.
Oh, you pulled me.
I did pull you, except I just consciously muted a mic and then forgot that I didn't unmute it. Anyway, I think for me, I agree with you on the offensive line assessment. I think when you look at individual players, it's tough to necessarily think that a Juwan Dowles or an Antoine Cordy, or, you know, Cordell Hudson when he was out for a little bit, or various other players, and Stephen Clark's now out for the season, that any of them would have been able to overcome the adjustments that are being demanded on defense. Obviously, you know, we've discussed the defense all season as a group that definitely hasn't had an easy time of changing its thinking, its philosophy. The linebackers, and they were the most talented group to begin with, have done a nice job of kind of shifting over time, and you can thank Zaire Franklin, I think, most importantly for that. But nonetheless, yeah, I don't think any of the defensive injuries take as much of a toll on this team overall as the linemen. You know, Colin Byrne seems like he's probably not going to be playing the rest of the season based on the hit to the head that he took. You saw in the second half the amount of pressure that you know, Zach Mahoney was under right up the middle. As a result, you know, you had Donnie Foster kind of coming in as the third string center when you think about the fact that Byrne was a backup. That didn't go well. It's nothing against Foster. It's just the situation he was put in. You know, Cody Conway was out for a couple weeks. Omari Palmer's missed a ton of time. Emmerich, obviously, career-ending injury, surgery. Not the severity, don't want to oversell that, was just because he was in his final year of eligibility. I'd have to go with you. I think it's the offensive line. I mentioned this in the article today, and for those listening yesterday, the amount of injuries per season is just far too normal. Like, Dan, do you remember a season where we didn't lose at least a couple, like, very important pieces by, like, the halfway point?
I mean, I can't remember exactly the details of, like, the Texas Bowl team, but I think they were mostly intact. They just weren't, like, great, but they, you know, got the job done. I'd say that those couple years there, I feel like we you know, obviously you're always going to have injuries in football, but I think those couple teams were mostly okay. But the last 3 years have just been a disaster. That's a Metsian level of injuries. I don't know if it's something – I don't know. I don't like to point blame at, like, training staffs or whatever, because it's very easy to do without, like, having any details. But it just does seem like, you know, teams have rashes of injuries for seasons, but – this is like a 2 or 3 year stretch where it seems a little bit beyond the pale in terms of how many guys have gone down consistently.
Well, and you trace back even further. I mean, yeah, we had that one Texas Bowl year, but and I think that the line was largely healthy, especially during 2012 season. But I'd say the first half of Marone's tenure, most of Greg Robinson's tenure, it was a hell of a lot of injuries in all the wrong places. I don't want to sit here and assign blame, but it is startling just how much this happens and how many injury reports are filled with names and how many times we're writing X name is out for the season as an article on the site every year.
Yeah, I wish someone would do. I mean, it's probably really difficult to do just based on, like, how injuries are reported very consistently across the board in college football. But I would almost love to see a study of, like, are there teams that definitively have bigger injury issues than others? I'm sure there are. I'd like to see, like, a kind of a scientific look at it, but that's also, like, a ton of work.
That's a ton of work, but you know what? I would venture a guess right off the bat that us, Vandy, Purdue, Rutgers at this point, maybe Maryland even before they went to the Big Ten, I'd say maybe Wake. You're looking at the teams that are going to be, you know, undersized for the most part, versus the elite talent in their division or conference, teams that might have had to take it a step up in competition, looking at, you know, us. Pitt, I feel like, recruited better than us by a long shot when we were in the Big East, so the step up for them wasn't nearly as big. I feel like that group of schools I named, there's a couple more. Kansas probably added to that list as well, Oregon State. But teams that are just continually overmatched by better athletes, and especially, like, in the Big Ten and the SEC and the ACC, you're going to find some teams with some much, much larger athletes than you have. I think that's where you're going to see the larger rash of injuries, if I had to guess.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. And it's hard to really stack up with what Maryland dealt with that one year where they were playing linebackers and quarterback. Although Syracuse came pretty close the last couple of years. So we just happen to have a Zach Mahoney lying around.
Well, yeah, we actually had our quarterback for most of seasons. Well, not, yeah. Dungy's actually played the majority of the last two seasons. It's not like Maryland where they were losing, you know, a quarterback a week for like five straight weeks. I think it was like 2 years in a row or something like that.
Well, they had guys like Stephon Diggs and Deion Lange and Amba Edetawa to throw to. So, like, especially kind of a shot to the gut, considering how good those guys are.
The waste of Stephon Diggs is one of the most puzzling things in recent college football memory. And that's just, like, I'm very hyper-focused and hyper-specific. But, like, Diggs had enough talent to be one of the better receivers in college football for, like, a three-year stretch. And instead, like, he was just kind of forgotten about. And it seems like he's done more as a pro, though, which is what he was supposed to do to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of flew under the radar, but I'm not totally shocked to see him kind of emerging as a really nice NFL receiver.
Agreed, agreed. I'm going to talk a little bit about the NC State game. Dan, on the rewatch, it was frustrating. The amount of three and outs, it wasn't even penalties as much this time, as much as it was three and outs. It was the fact the line collapsed on Mahoney immediately, really got some happy feet and rolling out of the pocket. Then he had a tendency to toss up some ducks. I don't hold that against him because he's not really a passing quarterback. But he also managed to put a couple, I think like three or four passes really on the money. And it was something we saw last year that he was just overthrowing those guys. This time around, Mahoney actually managed to deliver a couple passes right to the chest. Obviously with some various outcomes, we saw the really nice 81-yard touchdown catch from Edetawo. We saw another would have been a really nice grab from Alvin Cornelius on that BS chop block call. So yeah, I felt like Mahoney's definitely progressed as a passer, but based on the fact that we can't run the ball traditionally, I think that was about as good as it was to be expected from him against the Wolfpack.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation because I think based on the last 2 weeks, like I think Mahoney. If you're trying to win the football game, I think Mahoney is the better option than Austin Wilson. Obviously, we debated whether or not that was what was best for the team last week, and you know we had valid points, I think, on both sides. I think probably one of the more impressive coaching things that Tim Lester did here was find an offense that kind of worked for Zach Mahoney, and that is to say that the offense didn't really have enough of its own identity to, you know, not be worth scrapping for whatever Mahoney was good at. So now we have a very defined offensive identity, even when it's, you know, not running at full capacity. So Mahoney's being shoehorned into that, and he's definitely not built for the offense that we're running this year. Maybe if this was like a couple years down the road, it'd be better. But even then, like, he just isn't quite have the arm. I think he's, you know, not the accuracy, not the pure passer that, you know, Dungy's growing into. But like you said, he actually made some nice throws. I was impressed with some of the throws down the field he made. The touchdown throw was really nice. He had obviously Amba really well, and there was some decent deep throwing, which was not really a factor last year at all. But the offense just isn't designed to give him a lot to do with his legs, and he's such a crafty runner. It just doesn't suit those strengths, but it's not, you know, we're not like 2014 or 2015 Baylor where we're going to, like, just make something up on the fly because we're so, entrenched in our system that we can go design something like that. Like, we're still learning and still teaching our guys, you know, what they're supposed to be doing in the primary offense. So it's really not worth scrapping all of that and going to something crazy for like a 1 week shot, even if it, you know, is the difference between a bowl game and not a bowl game. So I think, you know, it's pretty clear that he gives the team the best chance to win, but it's clearly not an offense that's designed for his strengths, and it's no one's fault. It's just a situation that we're in. But we might have to get used to it because, you know, I think it's very questionable whether or not we see Dungy down the stretch here based on everything we've heard, which is, like, not a lot of specifics, but just kind of the vibe doesn't seem like Dungy's, you know, all that close to playing. And I don't know that it's worth risking his health for, you know, the chance to back into a 5-7 bowl by upsetting Pitt, which is probably still a bit of a long shot.
Yeah, I honestly don't think it's going to happen. Like, I don't think we're going to see him. I'm sort of okay with it for the most part. I mean, I'd love to be able to back into a bowl with 5-7, get those extra practices, but Dungy's still got to learn to protect himself a little bit more. The play calls for quarterback draws is not really going to help us out much. I know that's kind of just necessitated by the system this year, but as we've seen, like, I love Dungy as a player, but I don't necessarily know if he's ever going to be able to take hits the way, you know, with any sort of consistency without getting hurt. We don't know what his issue is. I would assume it's something in the neck or shoulder region. He has been on the sideline for the last two games. Seems largely okay. The one thing I've noticed both times, though, is he definitely has a towel on his neck both times, which may or may not indicate something else. I don't really know, and I'm not going to speculate. But, I think the bringing back Dungy for that is silly. And at the same time, putting in Wilson, putting in Wilson probably accomplishes the exact same thing as Mahoney at this point. Like, Mahoney, no, he may not be able to do the same things passing the ball, but Wilson, in a full game's worth of effort, really didn't prove he could do much passing the ball either. And in any case, if Mahoney's going to run the same offense that Dungy's running, and if he has second-team reps, and it seems like he's had those all season, and it seems like he has a rapport with guys like Alvin Cornelius and maybe some others who could see some increased time as the year goes on, that might actually help us out more in the long run. I mean, you and I were pretty concerned about, you know, Mahoney being able to run the same offense as Dungy, and no, he wasn't able to run it as well as Dungy did, but I think he did about as good of a job trying as you can. I don't think he set the team back any being out there against NC State, and he probably won't against Florida State and almost definitely Pitt as well.
Right. I just think he's the move right now, and obviously the team really likes him, and you know that goes a little bit of a ways, I think. So, and it's Florida State, so if there's any question about Dungy's health, which obviously there's a big question right now, I just don't think it's worth it. The good thing is that it really doesn't seem like it's a concussion, because he wouldn't be on the sideline. He wouldn't have returned to the sideline after he got hurt. So hopefully it's nothing, you know, majorly structural. It's just something that he can heal up from without, you know, making any real impact on next season if he is out for the rest of the year. Now, if he's, you know, 100% to Durham to play Pitt, then all, by all means. But I just don't think it's worth risking further damage on whatever it is.
Agreed. Dan, is there anything against NC State that stood out to you as most frustrating? I mean, fact of the matter is, the system is good enough to keep a mildly talented team in the game. NC State had every opportunity to pull away from that game, but didn't. I felt like the defense ended up breaking a few more times than they wanted to, but in the beginning was just doing a very good job of bending. I felt like they caused turnovers. I felt like they made stops. And then on the offensive end, I felt like they were still able to move the ball down the field. Not very well, but enough that they were within striking distance. I mean, if that chop block hadn't happened, you're potentially looking at a tie game in the fourth quarter. And I think that in and of itself is pretty miraculous, again, considering the injuries and considering how little time Mahoney spent with the first team offense all season.
Yeah, it's tough to get too worked up. I think the defense, you know, played fairly valiantly early, and I think just kind of those short drives on the offensive end, the quick three and outs, really hurt them, which is obviously a risk that you run with this offense, especially when your offense doesn't have its quarterback, and you're still trying to run at a similar pace. I think things were probably a little slower this week. I haven't looked at the numbers.
Well, the total plays, they only ran 53 plays, which
okay, so it was
pretty
a decent
bad.
Amount slower.
But yeah, the average snap time, I think, was about 4 seconds slower.
Yeah, so it was a combination of, like, quick drives being killed, and then, you know, you're just not going to have the same consistency when you have your backup quarterback, and that's to be assumed. So I struggle to take too much away from either side. The defense, you know, it struggles in the ways that it struggled all year. I think they were probably exacerbated based on the situation. I don't know. I don't want to take too much away from it. It was just, you know, a crappy circumstance. And unfortunately, they couldn't get the win, but they held in. I mean, it was a pretty close game late. So,
yeah,
you had a shot.
Yeah, and I think that's all, you know, we could really ask for. I mean, ideally, yeah, it would have been great to be 5-5. And then not really have as much stress on the team if a bowl was in the cards in those last two games, but didn't happen. I think this year, not that we're in gravy territory, but I think we're close to it, where anything that happens, especially given the injuries and especially given Dungy's absence, anything that happens past 4-8, I think we'll take. Which you know, that's a luxury that Babers gets in year one, but he's not going to get after that, despite the fact that the schedule doesn't necessarily cooperate.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I will say, if there's a positive, it might be that I think Cole Murphy hit all of his kicks, right?
He did. He was 2 for 2, and both of them were past 35 yards.
Yeah, all right, take that.
And, like, they weren't just good. Like, they looked really good.
Yeah, no, like, no issues. So that was good.
Yeah, unfortunately, the final game is outdoors at Pitt. So we'll see how that goes, and we'll see if there are any field goal tries against Florida State. But, yeah, that was definitely a sign in the right direction. I think he'd missed something like either 6 of 9 or 7 of 9 tries. So it was good to see him, yeah, definitely. I mean, he's not completely back on track, but good to see him get closer to the track.
Yeah, yeah, that Pitt game, like, I don't hope, you know, who knows if he'll be, how much he'll be needed, but I feel like that Pitt, every time we go to Pitt, it's just, like, the most, like,
unwatchable,
brutal,
just trash,
unwatchable. Man. I've been to, like, two of those games, awful, just not good, especially when a bull's on the line, the old, like, 2011 year. Yeah, Chan Jones not being able to make it in the end zone because he was, like, playing on one leg and picked off that pass that probably would have won the game. Just really bad and really rough to ride home 6 hours from.
Yeah, I was just watching in my room in San Francisco at the time, and I was just so dejected going in that, like, I was just numb to whatever happened that entire game. And speaking of numb, Dalvin Cook and Florida State coming to town.
Hoo boy.
How many yards does Dalvin Cook run for?
I'm going to go 178, but he won't play most of the fourth quarter.
I'm going to go 230, and
ooh.
I also don't think he plays in the fourth quarter.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, Dalvin's going to pound us, especially without Clark. Now we have we had an inexperienced defensive line. Now we have a very inexperienced defensive line. I'm very concerned with our ability to stop the run. You know, Florida State's a pretty solid team on the ground, especially when Cook's healthy. Otherwise, you know, they're not as great. I think, you know, Jock Patrick, 49 carries for 300 yards, a solid average, but he's not going to get the ball as much as Cook. Cook's a workhorse, and Cook is a guy who he can either beat you outside or between the tackles. We haven't seen him since 2 years ago at the Dome, right? Because we didn't, because last year he was out.
Was he?
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Not that that mattered, because Scott Schaefer decided to game plan for a starting quarterback who we were told all week would not play, and then got roasted by a backup quarterback for about 450 yards through the air. But whatever.
Yeah, I think we definitely gave Sean McGuire his career game, right? Like, that's 1,000%.
Yeah, that's Sean McGuire's got that, like, entire game, like, in a vault that he'll eventually, like, hang on his wall, like, frame by frame. Because, yeah, I mean, when
that was a game with the awful the Florida State touchdown where there was a million missed tackles.
Oh yeah, yeah, that game. I mean, that's really where that game is going to be immortalized. We've actually, the Syracuse defense has done a nice job of being a meme for the last 2 years.
And what else, you know, that's all you can really want.
Yeah. It's meme aspirations. Perfect.
Jesus.
That's what I want from my defense every year. Anyway, looking down the roster, Florida State fans don't seem thrilled with DeAndre Francois. I've seen both sides of that coin, so I understand their frustration, especially given, Everett Golson didn't play too bad, poorly at all last year.
He just didn't move the ball. Like, he was so non-dynamic, which is not what he was supposed to be.
Well, it's also coming off, like, Jameis Winston was just, like, a very dynamic player. Even in his, like, second year as a starter, where he wasn't as accurate or crisp, you knew the talent was there, and you knew what he was able to do. and he was still able to put points on the board. And I think, yeah, the step back to Golson. And then I feel like this might seem like a step back now, but I feel like Francois, I think Dylan from Tomahawk Nation in our Q&A today had said he's like a slightly better EJ Manuel is his ceiling, which I don't know. I'll take that.
I like Francois. I think it's tough when you've seen freshman Jameis Winston,
right,
and then you go to like Francois, who's just, you know, a very above average for a freshman quarterback.
Yeah, he's roughly
versus like one of the greatest seasons ever, and also a freshman quarterback. So yeah, they're probably a little spoiled by that. And it's Florida State, you know, they've had a lot of success recently, so I can see where you get spoiled. But I'm not thrilled to be playing him. I think he has all the talent. The one thing you cannot say about DeAndre Francois is that like he's not tough, because that dude gets lit up every game. He's probably thrilled about this game because his odds are it won't
zero
be as bad.
Rush.
But yeah, that guy gets killed every time they play anyone with a pass rush, including like the Clemson game where they almost won, the Ole Miss game in week one. Like, he just takes so many big shots and he just stays in there. And it's like Sean McGuire must be like, What has to happen for me to get some run? Because he takes more big licks than like anyone else in college football, and he keeps going out there, and he throws a really nice ball. I think he's going to be really good in a year or two. So unfortunately, this year when we're rebuilding and learning a new system is when we get him as a freshman. So let's not think about that too much, I guess.
Hooray! All right, before halftime. Dan, I don't think this is going to go well for Syracuse. I've got us losing by 25. Where's your head at right now?
Oh, I haven't even thought of a score. Let's go. It's at the Dome, right?
Yeah.
I kind of forgot about that until today. Let's go Florida State 41, Syracuse 14.
All right. Yeah, I mean, Florida State's defense, I'm definitely hot and cold on.
It's not great, but
it's not great, but it's good enough to put a stop to us, especially with Mahomes. Like, I'd entertain a much closer game with Dungy.
With Dungy, I think it could be like a two touchdown game. I think it would be fairly competitive.
Yeah, the closest one yet between these two teams could have been.
Yeah, this is the one team we haven't really put up. I mean, the one out of the ones we play every year, like we obviously haven't beaten Clemson, but we've come quite close twice for whatever reason.
The AJ Long game against Florida State 2 years ago wasn't bad. I mean, the final score was not great.
You know what? You're right. It wasn't. Yeah, but I wouldn't say we like put a stare on.
No,
but it was a decent game. Yeah, AJ Long played pretty well in that game.
Yeah, that was Steve Ishmael game.
Right. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So we played them tough that game. Last year was a disaster. The first year, the Jameis year was an absolute disaster.
Hangman game, of course.
But they murdered everyone that year, so how bad can you feel about it?
Every game against them has a like the blank attached to it. You have the Hangman game, you have the Steve Ishmael game, which is a positive one, and then you have the GIF game, which is not a compliment.
What sitcom is it that was like the one with the like for all the episodes? Is that Friends?
That was Friends.
I think it was Friends.
Yeah.
The one with Jameis Winston putting up 55 points.
Yeah, that one.
The one with AJ Long looking okay.
Looking like a college quarterback. Anyway, that brings us to halftime, Dan, where we get
Yay.
To talk about the things that we drank to wash down another Syracuse loss. Or celebrate a Syracuse basketball win, either one.
Beer is undefeated.
Beer is always undefeated.
Yes. So I had a couple decent things, nothing new this week, but I had both the Two Hearted Ale and the Amber from Bell's. Two Hearted's obviously a standby. Amber's pretty good too. Not like the greatest Amber of all time, but Bell's doesn't really make, I don't think they make anything that's like bad. So that was enjoyable. I had Omegang Wit, which I haven't had in a while. That was like one of my like legit, I always ordered that at Fagan's back in the day, and now I feel like I see it a lot, so I don't end up ordering it as much, but I got it over the weekend, and that was great. And then definitely the headliner this weekend was I got my hands on a bottle of Happy Birthday from Alpine,
yeah,
which, you know, you can find a little bit around here, but not that much, but it's, you know, definitely one of the better IPAs. I also like that apparently it's labeled a session, but it's like 5.9%. I'm like, you ain't no session.
A liar.
That is false advertising. That is not a session beer at all.
Still love it, though.
Yeah, so those were the highlights for me this weekend.
Fair enough. Swung down to the brewery late last week, had to pick some stuff up, had a Traveling Plum from them. It was an interesting one. It was a sour ale that was kind of like salty and spicy with dried plums. So not like a traditional ale, but brewery likes to make some weird shit sometimes. Also had this year's Autumn Maple. That's their kind of 10% fall beer. It's got some yams and some sweet. I think they purposely didn't put pumpkin, but it gets close enough. Had a Swami's IPA from Pizza Port. Had my first celebration from Sierra Nevada of the year. Plenty more to come, as I have a six-pack of it in my fridge as we speak. And then I also had a bottle of Black Tuesday from this year from the brewery that a buddy and me split. I actually haven't even drank my bottle from last year, so maybe I'll open that one in the next next month or so. And I have another 2016 bottle too, so we'll see. I don't really think, I mean, I haven't aged any of theirs more than a year, but we're coming up on a year for the 2015 bottle now. And also had a Velikor with raspberries from Monkish. They it's one of their sour blondes that they fruited. You know, a couple of weeks ago I mentioned on here, I think I did the boysenberry one. I had the raspberry one yesterday. And then sometime soon I'll have the other bottle. It was an apricot. So, yeah. Decent amount of drinking, all good stuff, and plenty more to come next week.
Very nice.
Indeed, indeed. Speaking of very nice things, Syracuse basketball. We thought things were going to go well. They have gone more than well. Syracuse looks like they could take all comers at this point. Am I overselling us, Dan?
I think we could take definitely most comers. This team's really good. We played two. We played Colgate, Holy Cross, but
we've looked bad against teams like that before.
Yeah, like you can still kind of understand where a team is, and you know. Obviously, like, in years past, we've been like, oh, we'll beat this team by 18, and that's fine. Like, we are lighting teams on fire. We're playing good D, even though you can tell the D is not, like, where it needs to be 100% yet. The offensive, like, the dynamic offense of this team is awesome. You still even have, like, Tyler Lydon hasn't really gotten it going yet, and he looked a lot better than his Holy Cross, but it's not even like everything's clicking and you know, like, you've hit the peak. Like, this team's going to get better. But man, like they're fun to watch and really, really impressive.
Yeah. I mean, they play with pace, they're spreading the ball around. I think that's the big thing for me too, is, you know, in the season preview episode, we were talking about, you know, is this team going to be able to spread the ball around? Are they going to be able to, you know, find out who the scorer is? I mean, just like you said, this isn't a team that's going to have, you know, quote unquote, the scorer every night, but you know, Andrew White seems to be, as we said before the season, you know, knocking on 18 to 20 points a night. Tyus Battle, depending, is kind of close behind. I know Tyler Roberson, surprisingly, has been able to put up points. Gillen, Lydon obviously seemed to get better in game two. And then Frank Howard, it seems like a guy who's an entirely different player, you know, from a season ago, which just has such a huge impact on this team's ability to kind of move forward with, you know, some of the old guys from last year, as well as all the new faces that we're seeing that hope to bring this team back to a Final Four.
Yeah, the Howard turnaround is probably the early storyline, aside from just the fact that you have 9 guys playing 13-plus minutes, which is just like a total, you know, it turns the Syracuse basketball thing on its head. And this is 2 games, but like, Damon Coleman's the low minutes guy by 5. Daywon Holman's probably going to start every game if he's healthy. Like, so, and it's not like he's a freshman who's just being thrown in there and then pulled. Like, I don't know who you take out of this rotation. And history tells me that you take at least one guy out of this rotation. I don't know who it is.
Just don't do it this year, Jim. Just play everybody.
I'm fine with that. I would love that. Especially because, like, I think when you have 9 guys that can play and you don't have to play any of them 30 minutes a game, like, that's a good problem. I think Torian Thompson's like the easy candidate, and he's looked really good. He's probably the best pure post player on offense. He's, you know, shown a really nice array of moves down there. You're not going to pull. I mean, Chukwu's going to play. He's averaging two blocks a game. He's not much of a scorer, but you can even tell, like, when he's gotten, like, really under the basket, he's had some nifty stuff down there. He just, you know, it's never going to be his offense. He's just not that guy. But then, like, the top six scorers in this team are – it's as impressive a group as I can remember outside of, like, the seven-man, like, bash unit that we had in 2010. Like, White, Roberson, especially when Roberson's, like, locked in, which he's looked really good so far, Lydon, Battle, Howard, Dillon, like – And especially with, like, Frank Howard, I don't think any of us expect him to be a big-time scorer. And, you know, he's averaging 9 points a game in 21 minutes, which is pretty damn good. The fact that he could even, like... The fact that you can rely on Frank Howard to be an offensive weapon that somebody needs to worry about, and, you know, if not, he can put up 15 points, like, that's huge. Especially because he's an awesome passer. He's starting to knock down the three a little bit. I don't think that's going to be a huge part of his game, but he's a threat out there, which is, you know, all you need to, like, really have this floor space effectively. All those guys can shoot except for Roberson.
He suddenly turned the corner where he knows how to finish at the rim. At least, I mean, not completely. We saw some misses in the first two games by him, but overall, he's still able to finish at the rim, and he's someone who, you know, really changes the dynamic for Syracuse, especially, you know, because if you have your big man on Coleman or Chukwu, and then you decide to shift Roberson, and you have Roberson at the four, who are you sliding over to beat him inside? I'm not sure there's anyone.
Right. If he's confident and goes up with authority, like, if he could chip in 10 points a game, that's massive, because you know he's in a board. You know he's, you know, athletic and will play solid D. He's been in the zone for 4 years now. Andrew White's, I think, as good as we could have hoped. Like, he's averaging 18 points in 27 minutes. That's awesome. He's fit in, like, perfectly. Gillen was an absolute, like, dynamo last night. Really awesome to watch. So it's hard to not be really excited about what's going on so far.
Yeah, I mean, looking at these field goal percentages, and I know James put up that article today about, you know, shooters are even better than expected. I mean, White isn't even in the top five in terms of shooting percentage right now, and he's hitting 50% of his shots. Roberson's hitting 70%. Gillen's hitting 69%. Frank Howard's hitting 78% of his shots. Thompson's hitting almost 55% of his shots. Lydon's hitting 54%. Like, yes.
The only guy who's struggling is Battle, and yeah. I'm not that worried about Tyus Battle.
No, not at all. Like, same, like, You can adjust for the opponent, sure, but, like, we've seen very good Syracuse teams in the past that aren't putting up these numbers against these opponents. So to me, I think that, you know, as there's more cohesion, as they learn the system more, we're certainly going to see even greater results from this group. Not to get ahead of myself, but I've rarely been this excited about a lineup this early in the season, and I'm very much looking forward to, like, Monmouth, I think, is the step above Colgate and Holy Cross. We'll see how much of a step, but I'm very much looking forward to seeing what they can do against Monmouth, whose name is, I don't know, oh, the Hawks. I had, like, Mountain Hawks in my head, but I knew that was Lehigh or whatever, or some other school. I don't know, but they're the Hawks, if you were wondering.
Yeah, I think Monmouth's definitely a nice step up. That'll tell us a lot. I think Monmouth took South Carolina down to the wire last night. I think they actually went to overtime, or they were very close to going to overtime.
Let me check.
And South Carolina also blew out Holy Cross, so, like, you can kind of start to piece together, like, some comparisons for that game, which is coming up next weekend. It's tough. Like, it's such a different team, because even, like, years past where we've played, you know, eight or nine guys in these early games, the ninth guy is not getting, like, a ton of major minutes, and you kind of know who's going to be pulled. Like, you knew in 08-09, like, Chris Joseph was going to play some spot minutes here and there, but in big games, he's not going to get in. Like, these guys all look like they're very much in the game plan, and Boeheim wants to use them. And depth has been such an issue for a couple of years now, and, you know, especially depth on the inside. Like, we have four guys we could probably get away with playing at center. Obviously, Coleman and Chukwu, but, you know, I bet we'll see a couple of net center in spots. Probably not every game, but you know, if they want to go small ball. And then you could probably stick Thompson there and be okay for a couple minutes here and there if there's foul trouble. If you have four guys who can play the five, like, you're in really, really good shape.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of teams that can say that in college basketball, and again, to be one of
them. Most don't have two.
Right. I mean, most Syracuse teams have not had two
in
the past. Yeah, so the fact that we're able to kind of count ourselves in that very elite group is certainly great. I know I wanted to bring up, too, I get, I don't know if you do, I get from teamrankings.com, I get, like, this predictions update where, like, they have the season simulated and kind of give you percentages on likelihood of things. They were saying, as of right now, that SU is projected to finish 24-7, 13-5 in the ACC. Going into the game yesterday, their odds of making the NCAA tournament were 75%. Yesterday was Tuesday. Yeah, their odds going into the Holy Cross game were 75%. Now their odds of making the NCAA tournament are up 11% to 86%. Their metrics say that Syracuse is the number 8 team in the country, but the number 5 team in the ACC, which goes to show just how deep this conference is, and they project a 93% chance to beat Monmouth. Also have a 10% shot to get an automatic bid. We're projected to have a 3 seed, and we have a 15% chance to reach the Final Four and a 4% chance to win the NCAAs, which is one of the higher marks that they have for anyone. So, again, that's just one methodology for predictions, but it's a very good one for at least our psyches right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we did our preview, I think I had like 24-7 and 13-5. So I feel better. I mean, I felt good then. I feel better about everything than I did then. So, I think this is going to be a very, very competitive team at the top of the ACC. Obviously, we need to see Duke. Duke has not played with anywhere near their total full team yet. And who knows how much of that'll get back. I know there are some legitimate injury concerns with Giles, especially over at Duke. But they just took a Kansas team to the wire with 3 of their top 4 guys out and Drayson Allen playing hobbled and poorly. So that's terrifying. But the Syracuse team, like, the scary thing about Syracuse is they should still gel. Like, 2 of these guys, or I guess really 3 or 4 of these guys did not play. Like, Chuku was on campus, but you have White, Gillen, and Thompson, and Battle, so 4, who were not part of this team last year in any capacity. And they are going to get better. They're going to get better in the zone. They're going to learn the offense better, although this offense, you know, is looking at a pretty it looks pretty good. Like, flow-wise and just, you know, ball movement, everything looks really sharp so far. So I would not be super excited about playing Syracuse if I was a team going forward, especially if you're a team named UConn, because holy crap.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about that. UConn's trash through 2 games. Doesn't mean they'll continue to be trash, but it means that they're definitely trash right now, which I really enjoy, though it's not going to help our RPI at all.
No, hopefully we're in like a post-RPI state of being this year. I made the joke on Twitter and a lot of people enjoyed it, but yeah, UConn, they've played Wagner, who's supposed to be like a contender for their conference, so they're maybe not terrible, and Northeastern, who knows if they're good or not. You know, maybe those are 2 better teams than what Syracuse has played, but Syracuse has won their 2 games by about 40 points. UConn has lost both of those games. That's not good when you were the preseason number 18 team in the country.
Not
great. No. Preseason's gone, guys. Sorry.
Oh, UConn.
They can't score. Like, no. It's Jalen Adams, and man, like, that the offense is bad.
Syracuse,
so I look forward to that game at MSG.
Feast on them, which I'm really looking forward to.
I hope. I mean, I did watch the Syracuse team, which went to a Final Four, lose to St. John's at the Darden last year.
Awesome.
So I don't know that UConn's going to be as bad as that St. John's team, but I will be in the Darden for that game too, so I'm hoping it's not a repeat, unless it means I don't know. Would you sign for losing to UConn this year if it meant that UConn went like 8-25 and that we went to the Final Four?
Yeah,
I think I would
fine.
Have to do that. I think that'd be a fair trade.
I saw, what was it? This is like their first 0-2 start since 1968.
Something like that.
Has Syracuse ever started 0-2?
Probably.
1967.
There's probably like some like really early season tournament or something where we weren't very good. I'm sure there was.
Yeah, like one of those seasons like before the Helms Foundation championships. Nobody talks about them, but we have a couple titles back then too.
We do. Banners are up.
Was it 1912 and 15 or something?
So I think they were close. I think they were like 32, maybe something like that. 20s, 30s, They were early, but they count.
That's fine.
Other people count them.
Yeah.
Kentucky counts a million of them.
Yeah, and Kentucky basketball is the Bama football of college hoops. So yeah, whatever. We can tack on a couple more. It's fine. I mean, Rutgers counts the 1869 championship for football.
They do that
when they went 1-1 against Princeton. But whatever. Like you do you, Rutgers. We'll be over here doing other things, like not getting destroyed by like the third worst team in the Big Ten this year. Anyway, that's a good segue. Not that Rutgers is near a college football playoff berth, but Michigan State had a college football playoff berth last year. So yeah, we could talk about that a smidge before we move on from this week. Syracuse basketball, it's tough to really over preview these terrible opponents too much. So yeah, we'll get into more detail as the season wears on, I promise. But the playoff, Dan. One thing really stuck out to me, and that was the fact that Western Michigan is now behind Boise, and that if Washington State keeps winning, and Boise finds its way into the Mountain West Conference championship game, that's going to continue despite the fact that they have a loss and Western Michigan does not.
Yeah, that's tough. Like, Western Michigan, if they go undefeated, should get that spot. I know Boise's probably, like, better by most metrics, but it's hard to really compare. Western Michigan, like, they've had some sloppy games, but they just look really good. And it's like, I would feel terrible for those guys if they ran the table, won the MAC championship, and didn't get that New Year's Six bid.
The good thing is that right now Boise would get eliminated from contention by way of losing the tiebreaker with Wyoming.
That is true. And you know, there's no guarantee they would beat San Diego State.
Right. And, well, there is then the question of...
With San Diego State.
How high can SDSU climb when they could potentially be 12-1 for the second straight season?
Yeah, there was something like that last year. I was actually kind of surprised they didn't, like, come close to sneaking into the back end of the rankings this week. But, you know, you had to get your...
AP.
Yeah, they were like 24, 25 in the AP.
But of course, just super late.
The playoff, you need to like...
Stanford.
You have to do so damn much. Yeah, Stanford's in there now.
Stanford's one of the top 25 teams. It's garbage.
Stanford's looked better this year, like in the last couple weeks, but it's not like they looked like, oh, they've turned it around. Like they
Where's Troy?
Looked a little better. Yeah, Troy should be in consideration there. Is Troy still... They're not undefeated. They have one loss, right? They lost to Clemson by 3 points. Yeah,
by six.
And
quality,
then they
quality losses. If we're looking at quality losses, where's Troy?
Free Troy. Hashtag free Troy. Yeah, that's it's. I don't know. It's definitely lazy, and there's just no the G5 teams have no representation. And I get it. Like the Power Five, for a G5 to get in, like you have to basically have been Houston running the table this year and getting help just based on the schedules. I totally understand it. But, like, you can throw them a bone at 18. 18 doesn't matter. Like, just give them some help in the back end and, like, at least show that you're paying attention.
This really should be a top 16. I know for the Football Writers Association, and I don't get to vote in it because, like, for some reason there's, like, a more elite group within the Football Writers that votes on this one, like their Super 16 poll or whatever. And, yeah, like, I don't really care. But point is, the Super 16 makes a lot more sense than this. All it does is just create narrative because then you say, oh, this team moved up from here to here, or this team moved up from here to here. Like, using top 25 wins as a metric is also, like, this silly, like, kind of self-fulfilling prophecy because, yeah, if you keep moving teams up, people just, like, let's say number 26 was Troy, and the line between Michigan and Clemson was top 25 wins. Well, like... You're saying that a win over Texas A&M or one of the other teams right at the bottom was really that much better than a win over the 26th best team? Or the fact that, you know, if Florida wins out or if Washington State wins out or, like, Colorado wins out, that the teams that they're beating are going to get knocked out of the top 25. So them winning hurts their resume? I'm just... This is why the primary driver should always be a new metric ranking, and then it's enhanced by a committee instead of what we're seeing here. Like, it doesn't have to be, you know, a pure play strength of schedule or whatever their strength of record crap is, or, you know, something like an S&P Plus. But it would be nice to have a number to go off of. And then, you know, we use the people as kind of a tiebreaker when there are statistical anomalies, which there can be.
Yeah, especially if you're going to switch things from year to year and, like, week to week.
Yeah.
It makes it really tough to, like, and I think there's a lot of issues. I think the whole way that college football is scheduled is now so counterproductive, because, especially when you had your postseason switch on you in a pretty quick fashion. It's not like the playoff was announced like 5 years before it happened. So now you have games that were scheduled like towards the end of the BCS when you thought that was what was determining things. And obviously there are some similarities in terms of what's valued and what isn't. But it just seems like they would go a long way to finding a cap or something in terms of scheduling new games. I don't know how feasible that is, but you have teams just scheduling games so far out, and it's impossible to know where you are as a program. Like, Syracuse has this issue for a number of – I mean, they don't help themselves at all. But, like, Syracuse would be so much better off if it could schedule, like, a year or two in advance and, like, actually know what the situation was. Like, why can't there just be, like, a weekend where all the ADs go together, you know, have some coffee, have some beers, and figure out, you know, who would make sense for me to play this year, and then just do it. Like, college basketball does it like that. Like, you pick your games less a couple months out. It just – I think it's bizarre. It's bizarre that they haven't figured that out. And I saw, you know, today we had, I think it was announced that Miami and A&M are scheduled for like 2023. I saw someone retweet, I don't think this was today, but I saw someone tweet that there's games for, I think it was Rutgers and someone are scheduled for like 2030. Like, the kids playing
scheduled
in
2030, I know that.
Yeah, the kids that are playing in those games are like 4 years old. Like, it's insane. You just don't know what your team's going to be. And so you get like, USC playing Alabama this year. USC would be in such better shape if they didn't have that Alabama loss to start the year. And obviously they were really bad after that, and they've turned it around. But like, if USC had just played a normal team that first week, and they could have maybe eased Sam Darnold in, maybe found out he was a much better option earlier, like, they could be on the playoff race. And now they're, you know, if they're in it, it's like the fringiest fringe team in it. So yeah, I think the scheduling is just a whole mess, especially when you have these criteria now that you're trying to fit, and you have all these different teams trying to reach different objectives. So, yeah, that was just a rant that I decided to go on 2 minutes ago, and here's where we are.
That's fine. Yeah, it actually is funny because it mirrors a similar rant that Bill Connolly and Godfrey went on Podcast Name Played Nobody. So I will avoid being repetitive of that, since I did listen to that episode already this week. But we'll say...
I don't think I have, so...
There you go. You're inspired just by life.
Just channeled each other.
Yeah.
I think I probably just listened to them enough where it's
expected.
Osmosis.
Yeah, if you did like me, I'd say like a 2 year buffer I could go with. Like only a schedule.
Yeah, because you kind of, I mean, guys 2 years fall, at a like, time. Fall cliffs and stuff, but you could figure it out in 2 years. Like 12? Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, like in 2016, you schedule 2017 and 2018. In 2017, you make sure you're scheduled through 2019. So, like, it would move like that. I just think that it's plenty of time for people to plan vacations, plan trips, facilities to be in order. These things can happen. I would very much like, I mean, and not just for that. Actually, it's not like I'm even sitting around campaigning that Syracuse should be excused. Quite the opposite. If anyone who's read anything I've written about scheduling would say that I don't think Syracuse should be excused at all. I think that they should be hammered for it, the fact that they don't know how to schedule. But that said, I think it would be better for everyone involved. Because look, like, you know, we say we don't know what's going to happen. Well, like, we've said that a lot about a lot of teams. Like, Maryland's recruiting a lot better since we put this, you know, game on the books for 2018 against them. And like, Wisconsin doesn't look like they're going anywhere anytime soon in terms of, you know, downward motion. Seems like they're very much on the uptick. And now that game in Madison in 2020 sounds even worse for Syracuse, even a good Syracuse team. So I guess, yeah, like I would just love a 2 year buffer means most of the same players, a lot of the same coaches, students at schools can get a little more excited about it, just as fans for certain trips and plan ahead, but not so much that, you know, like I said, when you see like a Nebraska-Oklahoma game scheduled for like 2028 or 29, Like you said, those kids are 4 or 5 years old. They're not going to be, it's not even a glimmer in their eye what games they're attending as players, as students. Most of the administrators involved aren't going to be there either. It's a pointless endeavor.
Only like a handful of the coaches that are, you know, in place.
At best.
Like how many coaches that are in their turns are, how many coaches in the country that are at schools that have, yeah, that are going to be there in 10 or 12 years.
Like three.
Maybe. Like it's, that's, I mean, I don't even know who they would be.
Yeah. I mean, we're, there's only like three or four now, but I don't think you can definitely say that those guys are going to be there.
Yeah. Like is Bob Stoops going to still be at Oklahoma? Probably not.
I would say definitely not. Mark Stoops will.
Saban will be retired. Mark Stoops at Georgia Oklahoma. That'll do well.
Saban will be retired.
Urban will probably be retired. Brian Kelly will probably have it, you know, combusted.
Sumlin has a lot of, like, if Sumlin can pull it together without injuries next year,
I think Sumlin's safe this year.
He's safe this year, but like he has like age on his side, where like he's somebody who can have a lot of staying power, and he's someone who can shape a culture there.
Yeah, but then you have to like hold off the NFL, which is tough. Like it's so hard to keep a coach for that long.
No, it definitely isn't,
like,
unless
you need everything to go right.
Yeah, and like you know, Urban's like always on the verge of a nervous breakdown. Like that's Harbaugh's gonna have a nervous breakdown, or like he's gonna do something that's gonna make him not be at Michigan anymore.
Harbaugh's like the weird one because Harbaugh could either be there for 30 years or he could leave like
three.
Tomorrow.
Yeah, like... Carolina Panthers want to coach.
He's just so enigmatic. Like I could see either of those things. I think there's like even odds that Harbaugh like dies while coaching Michigan, or goes to the NFL like right real quick, or dies like next year coaching Michigan like on the field just from sheer just wanted it too much.
How old's Chris Peterson? Does it feel like he's a candidate to be around?
Yeah, he's one of the guys because like he seems to really like that area, and like it obviously looked a lot different from Boise, but even him, I definitely found the wrong Chris Peterson.
Oh, did you find, which Chris Peterson did you find?
There's an actor. I always forget if Peterson is a D or a T, because I know he is the E at the end.
True.
Chris Peterson is 52.
Oh.
So yeah, he could potentially be there still.
Yeah, it depends on what he does.
That might be a leading candidate, and that's not a slam dunk at all.
Way to go, Chris Peterson. Anyway, before we log off, Dan, who is your top four? Do you think the committee was right, or do you think that you have some tweaks in there?
I don't really have a major problem with what the committee did. I think it's tough to really dock. I have less of a problem with Michigan being in there than Clemson, because Clemson's been like on the edge of a knife for a while now.
Right.
Michigan really hasn't been. Like they've had, what, two close games, and one was Wisconsin, so you're not going to like dock them for the Wisconsin game. And that Iowa is kind of a tough place to play. Iowa's not great, but they're not terrible. So Clemson, I could see you swapping in Louisville, but it's really hard to give Louisville the edge when Clemson has a much clearer path to the playoff or to the ACC title and beat them head-to-head. So I think that would maybe be the one thing. Maybe I would put in Louisville for now and see what happened, but then be ready to put Clemson back and have to win the ACC. But overall, I think you kind of have a rough top tier. Washington, I feel like, they probably haven't been gotten as much respect, and USC is quite good now after we made fun of them like a month and a half ago. And
I know
and
they're
the season around.
Yeah, since we made fun of them, they've what, lost one game?
I think the podcast we had that week, they like, they won a big game that weekend, and I don't know if they've lost since.
Just keep on rolling.
So you're welcome, Trojan fans. Yeah, I don't have a major problem with it. I think you can make an argument for Louisville or Clemson, but I think it's really tough to put Louisville ahead of Clemson based on the head-to-head.
Yeah, I agree. I think Louisville's had more impressive margin of victory, and just like if we're gonna go with game control, that's an easy way to look at Louisville. Like, but yeah, Clemson has the head-to-head win. Clemson has more impressive wins. I think that the win over Troy is kind of sitting in their back pocket too, to be honest.
They beat Auburn.
They beat Auburn. They beat Florida State. They beat Louisville. The quality of wins for Clemson far outpaces. I would say even outpaces Michigan, really.
They have the best Clemson has one of the best resumes. Alabama's resume isn't that great. They're just undefeated and bludgeoning everyone. But if they weren't winning by 30 points a game, you have a real argument. It's just they just look so good doing it that it's tough.
Yeah, so I'll have to agree with them. I'm going to go Alabama, Ohio State. I'm going to go Clemson, Michigan, though.
Fair.
Yeah, and that distinction really doesn't matter because Ohio State and Michigan are going to eliminate, or one of those teams gets eliminated, and I think when one of those teams gets eliminated, if Washington wins out, they're still in as number four.
I wouldn't have a problem with it. I have a little bit of pause just based on the way Washington's been treated this whole time by the committee. I don't think it would be a wrong decision. I just think the committee hasn't shown favorability towards Washington.
I just think the conference championship bonus kicks in postseason.
You have the conference championship, and they would have the Apple Cup, which would be good because Washington State's really good. It would also help them much. I don't know. Did Washington play Colorado? No, they didn't. Right?
No, they did not.
Okay, so I think it would actually help. I think the best thing for Washington would be Washington State beats Colorado this weekend. Washington State climbs into the top 18-ish. Beat Washington State at Washington State in the Apple Cup, which I believe is on the Palouse.
Yep.
And then if you can get a USC rematch in the Pac-12 championship, beat them soundly, then I think you're pretty good.
Then you erase the loss.
That's what Oregon did a couple years ago, right? They were the ones who did they lose in the regular season and then beat someone in the championship to kind of get So I think that would be a pretty good argument overall. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. Because obviously the tournament championships mean so much, but it's really hard to project exactly how much they mean until they happen, because that's when these rankings can jump. The Ohio State, we don't have that much information in front of us, but we've seen the Ohio State jump from a couple years ago. Last year, everything stuff was kind of boring down the stretch.
This year is not going to be boring.
It won't be boring because the Big Ten championship is a whole shit show. I don't need to see Penn State in the playoff. I would kind of hope that that doesn't happen.
I actually think their odds aren't as great as you would think looking at these rankings. I think that's
fair.
This is
I don't think they will beat Wisconsin.
No, this is a bit of a self plug. On the comeback, should be tomorrow. And for those listening or reading on the blog today, I did rank the two lost potential conference champs, and there are nine of those. And I had Florida number one, and Penn State was down around five.
That's interesting.
Well, look at Florida's schedule though. At LSU, at Florida State, Alabama on a neutral site.
Do you mean their chances? Was the ranking the chances for them to win the conference championship, or rank?
Basically, was saying ranking. If all of those teams were able to go unbeaten, what would be their chances to get into the playoff as a two-loss team?
Oh, yeah. I think I agree with that then. I thought you meant a power. I wasn't sure if you meant a power ranking, because I don't think Florida's the best of those teams by any means.
Florida's the worst of those teams.
They might be the worst. But if they beat Alabama on the table, it'd be tough to keep them out.
Who would have three, as far as late season impressive wins, those are three wins that very few teams would be able to even compare to.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Think we're going to get
a two loss?
Go ahead.
I
don't think we're going to get a total chaos situation like that this year, but I do look forward to the year that happens. This year's going to come close. I look forward to the year where we have three or four two loss teams and it's just total mayhem.
Yeah, I'd be fine with that. I think it's going to happen soon. I feel this year, I think we were looking for it to maybe be another 2007. It ended up, I don't think it is. Next year, though?
You never know.
The problem is, as long as Alabama is Alabama, Nick Saban is the lead for two, because Saban was with the Dolphins that year, right?
I think so. Yeah, because he took over Alabama in 08.
Yeah. So
08 was his first Alabama year, and then 09 is when he won his first title, because, Nick Saban took so much time to turn around Alabama.
And turn around Alabama is always a bit of a misnomer.
True.
But yeah. I mean, that year needed Nick Saban not in college football to happen. I just don't think that we can see 2007 levels of chaos with him on the sidelines.
Nick Saban is the constant. He keeps everything spinning. He keeps Daniel Faraday from falling into the vortex of the island.
What a guy. All right. On that note, Dan, thank you for joining, as always. It was a good time.
Yes, always is.
And any parting words for you about Syracuse or anything else?
No, I hope everyone's as excited as we are about basketball season, because, like, I hope we're not being, like, too overcome with what we've seen so far, but I really don't. I think that this team is quite good, and a nice way to ease out of a interesting football season in terms of, like, I think it's hard to be, like, overly disappointed, but also it's hard to be, like, super jazzed. So I think it's nice that college basketball is here when it is.
I would second that. So everyone, thank you for listening. That was Dan. I'm John. You can rate, review, subscribe to Troy News and Absolute Podcast on iTunes, on Blog Talk, maybe on Android, I'm not sure. And go Orange.
Go Orange.